rules when that happens, the appellant goes first, and our order will be the appellant, government, and then if requested, rebuttal by the appellant. Are the parties ready to proceed? Okay, we'll hear first from the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Paul Clement for the appellant, and if with the Court's leave, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Granted.
Your Honors, we are here today because the Court below misinterpreted the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in a manner that left the religious liberty rights of service members seriously underprotected. In the view of the Court below, RFRA protects only religious practices that are, quote, part of a system of religious beliefs, and affirmatively does not protect, quote, personal beliefs grounded solely upon subjective ideas about religious practices, end quote. That standard is directly contrary to the intent of Congress and the teachings of the Supreme Court, and the government does not even defend that holding of the Court below today. But while the government is correct to confess error concerning that miserly reading of RFRA, the government continues to advance arguments that are equally troubling. For example, in pointing to a compelling interest, the government suggests that there was the possibility of a looming Establishment Clause problem if my client were allowed to post these biblical verses in her workstation. And in arguing about narrow tailoring, the government suggests that, quote, she could have invoked the Trinity at home, end quote.
Those points aside, explain to me first how you define substantial burden for purposes of RFRA, and then second, how this case meets that.
Sure, Your Honor. In terms of the substantial burden, I think that any time the government imposes the possibility of criminal punishment on somebody's exercise of religion, you have the easy case for a substantial burden. And I think the best way to illustrate that is to look to the Yoder decision of the Supreme Court involving the Amish in Wisconsin, because there you had a criminal prohibition backed by a $5 fine. And so I think the Yoder decision, which is one of the two decisions that Congress specifically pointed to in RFRA as embodying the standard that they wanted to embrace in the statute, I mean, there you have it, that if you have a criminal prohibition backed even by a modest fine, you have a substantial burden.
Okay, well, I guess let me be a little more specific. What specifically, how did the request that you remove the signs or the order that you remove the signs coerce her to act contrary to her religious beliefs?
Well, because her religious belief was that she wanted to exercise her religion by making these postings.
Okay, well, let me be even more specific. How did it force her to engage in conduct that her religion forbids or prevent her from engaging in conduct that her religion requires?
Well, with all...
Because, I mean, that seems to be the test that most courts use.
Well, I don't think that that would be an accurate statement of what RFRA protects, particularly with respect to the use of the word requires. And I think you need to go no further with respect, Your Honor, than the statutory definition in RFRA itself, because it specifically says, and now I'd be quoting from...
You're collapsing the two different prongs, right? I mean, there's the exercise of religion, and there's a substantial burden on the exercise of religion. They can't do the same thing.
I agree, Your Honor, but starting with the exercise of religion, it is clear from the statute itself that it is an exercise of religion whether or not, and now I'm quoting from the statute, whether or not compelled by or central to a system of religious beliefs. So when you have something that is a religious exercise that is part...
They are the same thing.
No, they're not the same thing. You can inconvenience a religious practice, and in doing so, not impose a substantial burden on it. You can have a burden on religion that is insubstantial. If the government, you know, if the government changes the speed limit on the road that I take to Mass, and it, you know, now takes me twice as long to get there, that is a burden on my religious practice. But it's not a substantial burden. I just have to leave a little bit earlier. But if they criminalize the practice of going to Mass, even if it's a daily Mass, and not something that's compelled by my religion, that is still a substantial burden on religious exercise.
Let me ask you another question. In your view, what import, if any, is the fact that from the record it appears the staff sergeant had no idea that this was an exercise of religion?
Well, I don't think it's outcome determinative. I also wouldn't want the court to think that that's something that we concede. I mean, I think if...
I'm not asking you to concede it. I'm just saying, based on the record, you know, that's the state of the record. I'm accepting that you're not conceding it, but explain how, if at all, that matters.
Well, so just so we're clear, I mean, on this state of the record, I would disagree with your assessment of the record. I think, you know, the relevant place is Joint Appendix page 116 and 117, and you can read that. I have no monopoly on sort of reading that, but I read that as making clear to Staff Sergeant Alexander that this was religion. She was complaining about her religion being...
For the sake of my question,
sure.
The record is clear that she didn't know.
Right. Then I still don't think that would be outcome determinative in a case like this. Because, first of all, you know, I think that this is a situation where, you know, maybe the right way to ask the question is whether the staff sergeant was reasonably on notice that this could be religious. And I think that standard is clearly satisfied on the record. But whatever the staff sergeant knew, I mean, you know, ultimately the substantial burden on religious exercise is not just the direct order to take down the religious display, but also as culminating in a special court-martial for the refusal to do that. And at some point in this process, before you make this a specification of a special court-martial, somebody, the commander, somebody should have been on notice that this at least raised a question where they needed to dig further and say...
The military is a very structured society, and it has regulations that require when an individual wants to exercise their religious beliefs, that they, and it interferes with something military, that they request accommodation. And here, there was no request for accommodation, and I realize your argument is, well, the staff sergeant was aware that it was religious, but that's not the same as requesting, through the proper procedures, an accommodation. And the military is full of examples where individuals have requested accommodation for religious purposes, and they've been granted. And so now how can you hold the military at fault when no accommodation was requested?
Well, Your Honor, I take your points about the nature of the military, and I'm not here to tell you that as a best practices matter that seeking an accommodation wouldn't have been the, you know, the best thing for my client to do under the circumstances. But at the end of the day, the question is, does RFRA allow the military to impose what effectively amounts to an exhaustion requirement? And with all due respect, I don't think that that's something that the statute allows. I don't think any other government entity to which RFRA applies can have an exhaustion requirement. I don't think that's consistent with the statute, which plainly says that RFRA can be raised as a defense in judicial proceedings, which is the antithesis of an exhaustion requirement.
And that's despite the language in both the House and Senate conference reports in the adoption of RFRA, that they were aware that when it was applied in the military that courts would give deference to the specific demands of the military society.
Absolutely, Your Honor, but it's one thing to give deference to the military's articulation of what their compelling interest is. It's another thing to allow the government to, the military to engraft an exhaustion requirement on the statute that isn't there in the rest of the government.
Now, this is sort of tied to my question about knowledge, right? I mean, if you look at Holt and Hobby Lobby, in most of the cases in this area, right, they will where someone either asks for an injunction or they requested an exemption from an existing rule or regulation, right? And then they were able to develop the record and litigate the question. Here we have something that, you know, the staff sergeant may or may not have known. It certainly wasn't a clearly, obviously, really, it wasn't like she wanted to wear, for example, a headdress, or that she was doing, you know, she, you know, had a Bible and would wanted to pray, or something like that. I mean, it was signs that, you know, you can say that they were religious, you can say that maybe they were, maybe they weren't. But wouldn't we be in a better position if we had a developed record, if she requested something?
Well, I think the RFRA...
Would you agree that that's how the cases usually come up?
I think that's how they...
Someone is asked to intuit that it's a practice of religion, so the person says either they want an exemption or they want an injunction.
Well, yes, that's right, Your Honor, but I don't think Holt would have been decided differently by the Supreme Court if the inmate in that case had been told flat out, you got to get rid of that beard. And, you know, this is not a situation that really lent itself to an accommodation request. I'm not saying she couldn't have, and if I were counseling her in real time at the time, I would have said, let's go try to get an accommodation to this. I don't want to be misunderstood. But she was told, you know, there wasn't some clear rule that said nothing on your desk. And then she was kind of on notice of that clear rule and then could have sought an accommodation. She was told, take it down. And at that point, I mean, you know, it seems like it's a little bit too late for an accommodation. But in all events, I think, you know, it still gets to the question. I don't doubt that that's the way that it would have been perfect if this had proceeded in that way. But
I'm asking how it is that she meets the her burden to prove the first two prongs when we don't have a developed record.
Well,
and where there is an accommodation, right, and she didn't seek to take advantage of it.
Well, a couple of points, Your Honor. First of all, in terms of the state of the record where it is now, I don't think you can foist that properly on my client, because the opportunity to complain about the state of the record and sincerity and the substantial burden was no later for the government than in their brief in the court below. And they did not raise those arguments in their brief in the court below. What they did instead is they said, this is like the Supreme Court Yarmulke case, and there's a compelling interest, and there's no least restrictive alternative. They leapt to the merits, which is their right. They can try to win this case on any ground that they want, but they swung for the fences, and they hit something that turns out is actually unsustainable. They got so broad a ruling from the court below that they can't sustain it. No, I don't think it does, Your Honor, but I do think you don't have to reach issues that have been forfeited by the litigants, and I think, and certainly to the extent that there's a concern about the state of the record as it affects my client's claim. I mean, I don't really, again, with all due respect, I don't think this is a hard question on substantial burden. She got a special court martial for posting these biblical passages. I also think that with all due respect to Staff Sergeant Alexander, I mean, the military trial judge, when it came to considering the legality of the order, had no trouble recognizing that these were biblical verses, and that was part and parcel of why he thought it would be distracting to other members of the military. So,
counsel, what are commanders to do? The United States is supposed to be neutral in matters of religion. The armed forces have a unique and compelling interest in the obedience to lawful orders. In a case like this, where the judge found, and the court below found, as a matter of fact, that the motives were at best mixed, that the motive of telling her supervisor to blow off was combined with whatever religious practice motive was here. And the staff sergeant told her to take it down because it's basically a public flouting of authority. Does the United States, does the armed forces have to concede this because a cloak of religion is thrown over?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, you've characterized the findings of the lower court or the proceedings before the lower court in a way that I don't think the record supports with all due respect. But to get to the nub of your question,
yeah,
which is what is a commander supposed to do, I think that as I read the military directive, it's not just that the military and the United States government is supposed to be neutral to religion. They are also supposed to, when they can, accommodate religious exercise.
Well, and that's, but you requested no accommodation, so now we're back to Judge Ryan's question.
Well,
but go on.
But I'm trying to be practical, which is to say, I mean, look, in a perfect case, the accommodation is asked for, and maybe the accommodation is granted.
But all right,
in the real world, but in the real world, before you ring somebody up for a special court martial for what you posted on your desk, somebody ought to say, gee whiz, was that religious? Were they trying to engage in religious speech?
Well,
and if they were, let's put the brakes on
that
this.
That gets back to the nub of my question. Does throwing a cloak of religion over to excuse it from criminal liability? If it, in fact, is at least partly motivated by a desire to thumb her nose at her supervisor. I know you don't agree with me on the state of the record.
Absolutely.
But take my question as I propound it.
If I take it as a hypothetical question.
Yeah.
And I would say no. I mean, which is to say, if there's a finding that this is not a sincere religious belief, strike one.
I don't think that was the finding.
Okay.
Okay. And of course, getting the government into digging into the sincerity of religious beliefs raises a whole bunch of other questions, but that's not before us.
Well, that's something, though, that is something that the inquiry allows. So the court doesn't allow you to look into the centrality, but it does allow you to look into sincerity.
I don't think that was what the findings were below, but I think the findings below were that what the religious quotient of it was sincere, but that it was mixed with a desire to thumb her nose with her supervisor.
Well, again, I'll answer it as a hypothetical. I don't see where you're finding that finding in the record. But if there were that kind of finding, that seems like exactly the kind of situation where the military should prevail. But if you have a case where it's just religion,
okay,
and all they want to do, you know, it's a little snippet of the Our Father, it's a little snippet of one of the Ten Commandments, whatever it is, doesn't have to be Christianity. But if there's a little snippet there, and there's, you know, that should not give rise to a special court-martial, if that's all it is. If it's something more, if it's a cover, or even if it's a mixed motive. I mean, you know, I think, you know, the deference...
Well, we're not talking a sham here.
Right.
Yeah.
But even your mixed motive case, I mean, I think that's where the deference to the military comes in. But I don't think it comes in by being able to impose an exhaustion requirement that obviates anybody to ask those questions. And I think if the commander, in the context like this, had, before they took this and made this one of the specifications, said, let's look a little deeper into this, and let's make sure that we're not punishing religion here, then maybe the commander would have come in and had a very clear conception of whether this was pure religion or this was a mixture, in which case I think the military would be on a much stronger footing in punishing the conduct.
And is your concern not with the order to remove the signs or taking down the signs, but rather with the fact that you went to court martial for disobeying the order?
It's the combination of the two. I mean, and I think that's fair, Your Honor, because when you're looking at the substantial burden analysis, I think you have to look at what total burden the government's putting on the religious exercise.
Would it have been different if she had been subject to administrative sanctions up to discharge?
It might have, Your Honor. I mean, I don't want to mislead you. I'd probably still be here making...
Aside everything else of which she was convicted that's not involved in this case.
I don't think that's the right way. That's not how I read the cases, Your Honor. I think you take into account the penalty for, I mean, that's part of the compulsion. It's part of the question of whether the burden that's being placed on your religion is substantial. If the ultimate consequence of all of this posting had been that you needed to get a permit, I think that's a burden but not a substantial burden. If the ultimate consequence of this is that you get court-martialed for it, I mean, that's a substantial burden. So I think you do have to take that into account as part of the analysis. And I do think you don't have to look, you know, down, you know, all the way down the road to the consequences in life later on, but I do think you have to look at the punishment that the government's imposing for what is an exercise of religion. I realize my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from the government.
Your Honors, and may it please the Court, my name is Brian Keller, and along with Colonel Mark Jamison, I represent the United States. I'd like to make 3 points. One, I'd like to quickly talk about waiver. Second, I'd like to talk about substantial burden, which goes both to the accommodation and to the mismatch arguments. And third, I'd like to talk about why this specific practice of religion was not a sincere
one. Was what? I didn't catch that.
Was not a sincere one, Your Honor.
Was not what?
Was not a sincere one.
Sincere. Okay.
Not sincere one.
First, with regard to the waiver. The waiver issue is distinct from accommodation, so I don't want to confuse the two. But with regard to the waiver, just very briefly, this is the best way to dispose of this case for 3 reasons. One, RCM 905 is the only baked-in waiver rule here. Every other waiver rule is a prudential and precedential rule. Per Bradley, this is a good time to tell litigants when you've got a RFRA motion that you're going to raise in a court-martial, and these have not been raised a lot in the past, this is a good place to tell litigants what you need to do to actually raise that. The second issue is that when you've got difficult statutory issues, as we do here, one of those statutory, you should avoid doing that and just go to the waiver. One of those statutory issues is the fact that, and this is very confusing with RFRA, all.
With respect to waiver, I mean, she did say at court-martial, however belatedly, that part of the reason that she did this, I mean, part of her testimony is that it was based on religion.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a requirement in RFRA? I mean, I understand that the burden is on her to prove the first prongs, but I don't think that RFRA says that the court's relieved from noticing a RFRA problem if the self-defending accused doesn't know to raise it in a proper form.
And let me just add to that. She referenced the DOD instruction 1300.17, which references RFRA.
She did, Your Honor, but the DOD instruction specifically talks about an accommodation procedure. It references RFRA. But that's kind of like slapping down the manual and saying, you know, I object, this should be dismissed. I mean, he had.
But she was going pro se.
She was going pro se, but we think that when she had 10 pages of colloquy and she did this with eyes wide open, she knew what she was doing. And she asked for, I mean, she specifically said the right words, right? She said, I want a lawful order analysis. She wants a Brown v. Glines regular lawful order analysis. She asked for that. She says, reasonably, it's not contrary to good order and discipline. The DOD says I can do whatever I want as long as it's not contrary to good order and discipline. That's exactly what the judge did. But, you know, be that as it may.
So are you saying that she was required to use the magic words RFRA in the course of her argument as she's proceeding pro se in the trial court?
All we're saying, Your Honor, is that when a litigant is raising RFRA, they should say that I want a RFRA statutory defense and I just don't.
So you are saying that they have to invoke RFRA.
You should have said more.
You would.
Lance Corporal, who is proceeding pro se, after she refers to the fact that this was religious in nature, after, as the Chief Judge notes, she's invoking a DOD rule that refers to RFRA, you're saying that our service members need to specifically invoke RFRA for it to be preserved?
Well, I think the answer is she needed to do more, and this really goes to the third reason.
But what more specifically did she need to do, in your view?
Well, she should have said specifically, I want to refer statutory defense. She should have tried to say exactly what the substantial burden was here, and there's a mismatch here.
Counsel, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but you would agree that we look at proceedings where an individual is representing themselves differently than if an attorney is representing them, and we give them more leeway.
She had the assistance of an attorney throughout, so, I mean, and she continually did that. But be that as it may.
Let's just assume for the sake of argument that you should move on to your other 2 points.
I would love to do that, Your Honor. With regard to substantial burden, the Brown v. Glines case, I think, is very instructive here, and it's not, you don't need to rule on Brown v. Glines, but I think if you look at Brown v. Glines, it's very helpful. So Brown v. Glines talks about the prior restraints, and it says it's okay for a base commander to put restraints on speech before it comes on base. But very interesting in Brown, and I think that helpful in Brown to interpreting what substantial burden means in the RFRA context, is the language in Brown v. Glines that says when a court is interpreting whether a statute interferes, pierces that good order and discipline relationship between a commander and a service member, they should be loath to interpret the statute that way. Here we have the Uniform Code of Military Justice created many decades ago. That is a constitutional construct of the Constitution between the political branches, and Congress never said in RFRA that they intended to pierce that good order and discipline relationship. So Brown v. Glines. Yes, Your Honor. I think that there are two aspects of substantial burden that the government can win on and does win on in this case, and that's both with regard to the accommodation and also with regard to the mismatch. So first, with regard to the accommodation, Friday, I think, is directly on point, and that's the Tenth Circuit case, the Eagle Feathers case, and they say the way they interpret the substantial burden is that if you don't actually ask for the leave to do the criminal act you're doing, then you can be prosecuted for that. Friday is directly on point, and you should go with that. I think the DOD, the DOD and the Second Evans both say that you need to seek accommodation before you actually violate orders. And this goes to the point that my friend made about it's too late once you put the signs up to seek an accommodation. That's simply not true if you read the accommodation requirement. The accommodation requirement says that you have to go ahead and obey the orders no matter what for 7 days. And then you have to wait for 7 days while the commander looks at that written request to determine whether you're going to flout the orders.
So well, you know, it's one thing to request an accommodation to wear a beard or to wear a turban or to wear a yarmulke, although Congress took that one off the table. But it's another thing to request an accommodation to you know, dear Mr. Commander, I would like to exercise my religion by putting up signs that tell my supervisor to bug off. Number one, I doubt that the requested accommodation would be granted. And number two, is that really the kind of thing you ask for an accommodation for?
Well, Your Honor, I think that that is that's a problem with the state of the record at trial here, which is that nobody, this is a big wag the dog. Nobody thought it was referred to trial, I mean, to be honest. So when the judge was doing his, it's a wag the dog, Your Honor, because nobody thought at trial this was a RFRA analysis.
Nobody thought that at trial, but you're placing the burden on the lance corporal to raise it? Raises during the trial that
I'm not arguing
it was based
anymore.
On the fact that it was religious-based. Now you're saying the government didn't realize this was a RFRA case either.
Well,
the military judge didn't recognize it was a RFRA case either.
That's right, Your Honor. I mean, I guess my point is answering the question that I think that I was asked was that, here, the judge did a regular lawful order analysis and said the words could be contrary to guard and discipline. He wasn't looking at the RFRA analysis. I understand that. But nobody, Staff Sergeant Alexander's testimony was simply that I walked into the office. She's a Marine. I walked into the office. It was cluttered. I wanted the signs down. That's all she said. You know, there was no cross-examination about whether she thought the signs were religious. There was no cross-examination about the conversation that she might have had with the appellant, as the appellant described it later. The self-conflicting testimony, but so nobody knew exactly what the signs were at the time. So I'm not sure that it was clear. I don't know if it was clear to the commander that they were sticking it to the commander at that point. It was clear, I think, to the judge when he saw her in trial and he saw all the different other things that she'd done, which was the gate thing where she knew actually to say something. And I think that goes to your point too, Your Honor, that when she was at the gate duty, she was completely free to say, no, I got to go to church and sleep, instead of actually doing what her commander told her. And I think the same thing with the medical chit. And also with regard to the request mask. She knew how to do the stuff if she wanted to. She was very savvy. But in this case, for whatever reason, she decided sub silentio to go and put the signs up every time somebody else told her to take them down.
Counsel, appellant makes a very logical, simple argument, as I understand it. And that is, if your exercise of religion results in a criminal sanction, that's a substantial burden on your exercise of religion. Do you dispute that?
I think that it is linked to the back to the order. So if she was, again, she was not punished for, so I think no and yes. I mean, I think they're linked. The two are linked, right? The order is you must take the signs down.
Well, you disagree that that's a fair exercise of religion, I guess.
Well, that, I think not necessarily, Your Honor. I mean,
because if it is a fair exercise of religion, and it did result in a court-martial, that was a substantial burden, was it not?
Well, that raises two problems, Your Honor. One is the problem with RFRA, that it is easy to conflate, but all the facts apply to every prong of RFRA. So some courts take the facts and say, well, the fact that she didn't tell anybody is a sincerity issue.
Well, maybe we don't have sufficient facts in this case to make a decision of law.
I don't think that's... we would disagree, Your Honor. I mean, if you look at this,
everybody's asking us to find all these facts.
Well, no, I think the facts are in the record with regard to the substantial burden, both with regard to the accommodation, and I think there's ample case law to say that if you don't request an accommodation both under RLUIPA and under RFRA, then there is no substantial burden. And I think Brown helps you analyze whether there's a substantial, how that applies to the substantial burden. In the RLUIPA cases, of course, you've got to have a facially neutral, generally applicable rule. I think if you take Brown and apply it to this accommodation rule that you have, both from Doty and from the SECNAV, you can say that you've got
to
reg out.
But getting to Senior Judge Cox's point, why are we going to go through Brown and apply that language and so forth when we can look at the phrase substantial burden and make a common sense determination here about whether it was a substantial burden?
All I'm saying, Your Honor, is that I think Brown helps interpret what substantial burden means. The language in Brown that says you don't pierce the commander-subordinate relationship in the military in a statute without looking to see whether Congress specifically said they're doing that, and they didn't do that in RFRA. And I think that substantial burden...
They made it applicable to the armed forces. They didn't need to.
They did.
It's not a constitutional question. It's a statutory question.
Yes, sir.
And they made it applicable to the armed forces. Doesn't that mean they intended it to apply to the armed forces basically in the same way, saving whatever they said in report language? They didn't say it in the statute.
And absolutely it does apply. We're not saying it doesn't apply to the military.
Well, but more than that, they put some bromides in the report language. But when you get to the statute, it's just for the government as a whole. You know, for everybody as a whole until City of Bernie, and for the federal government as a whole. So where do we go?
Well, I think you go to two places. One is to the accommodation. And again, you don't need Brown for this. I think Brown helps you interpret substantial burden. That's my only point with Brown. But you've got the accommodation issue, and then you've got
Why is accommodation relevant here? That's not the issue in front of us. The issue is the substantial burden, the specific acts that were taken by the NCO here.
And that is my point, Your Honor, that the accommodation actually is the lack of the substantial burden. The fact that she has a route to not be coerced to abandon her religion makes that not substantial. And that's what the case law says. I think that's what Friday says. And I think that if you look at this as an escape valve, there's three different rubrics here. One is the rubric which all service members have to obey orders immediately. The second rubric is if you're religious, you have the DOTI and the SecNavance that says that if you submit a request to your commander, you get an out. The only deal is you have to wait for 7 days. But appellant has already conceded that she has no problem with that out. But somehow she wants the third rubric, which is I got to do what I want to do now without waiting 7 days, which seems nonsensical given the second rubric.
Well, there's actually a fourth rubric, and that is that RFRA applies to the military, and is it your argument that it applies differently to the military than it does to all other instances?
No, Your Honor. Accommodation and mismatch are two reasons that this is not a substantial burden. Brown helps you interpret both of those things in the in substantial burden problem.
So do you have a response to the question I asked the Appellant's Counsel with respect to knowledge? Does it matter whether or not the staff sergeant knew that posting these signs had some religious meaning? And do you have an opinion as to whether she did know?
I think the record does not demonstrate that she knew that the signs were religious.
Does it matter?
I think that she still...
Like Abercrombie is the Title VII case, right?
Right.
So, I mean, it's not
right.
Directly analogous.
Right.
At least, Creed in that case suggests that some, they don't call it knowledge, but that you can't be violating people's rights if you don't know that's not your motive.
Right. Well, I think that still substantial actually means something, and substantial is a prong of RFRA that's not a prong of that. So if you're going to interpret substantial to mean something, it's got to mean something. You can't just... read it out of the statute. But again, this is.
I thought you had already agreed with me that a criminal conviction is a substantial burden.
Well, I think the criminal conviction is linked by the UCMJ back to her duty to obey orders, back to her coming into the military saying she had.
Well, I understand that part of your argument.
And Brown links to that, I think, Your Honor. You'd have to interpret RFRA to pierce that relationship without Congress actually saying they wanted to. And as I think was noted earlier, the legislative history suggests that there's still some kind of deference, and that shouldn't be on the back end. Shifting it to the government. For instance, if you are on the front lines in Afghanistan and you're a Scientologist and you decide, well, I just want to have an audit right now, so you run with all your buddies and have an audit in the middle of a firefight. Well, that doesn't make much sense. But theoretically, the way we're reading it now, that's a substantial burden. You have to shift the burden to the government because it was religious. That can't be right.
The problem that I'm having with both of your definitions of substantial burden is it's not very satisfying, right? I mean, in Hobby Lobby, the religious belief was abortion is bad. Right, that was the religious belief. And the problem was that engaging in doing what they wanted them to do required them to do something that was contrary to that belief, right? And there was a consequence. So here, the religious practice is, she wants to post the signs, right? But I don't get the intermediate step. Like, I get that, and I get the consequence, which is she violates the order and doesn't do. But what is it that she that Do you understand what I'm saying? It's like,
I think
is
I
the
do.
Religious practice?
That's right.
Our religious practice is posting signs.
I think, can I give it a shot? I have 4 minutes, so I hopefully won't do the speed debate thing here, but that's the mismatch argument, and I think that's the substantial burden issue. So if you have a Venn diagram of what is religious, that's huge. Everything's religious.
Right.
But that can't be, you say it's religious and all of a sudden you get it. You get a defense. So the question is there a match between what you assert is your religious practice when you claim RFRA and what you've actually proved at trial? So Holt, I need to have a beard, beard shaved, done. Match, substantial burden. I want to spread religious messages with chalk. Well, you know, the circle of you can't chalk in front of the White House overlaps a little bit with that, but it doesn't exclude the fact that you can go, this is Mahoney, it doesn't exclude the fact that you can go and you can chalk elsewhere. Well, does that raise the Holt issue, which is where Justice Alito says, well, alternative means aren't relevant. Well, we respectfully disagree with our friend that it's never relevant. It is relevant if there's a mismatch. So if all she says in this case, which is that I got three signs and they got a religious message and I got to put them up, or, you know, protection of the... And I'm not, well, exactly. And I'm three signs, religious message, I want to put them up. What she didn't say, so this is, she's got a practice of religion, which is A. Let me go back a little bit very quickly. So if you say my practice of religion...
Let's be precise. She has an exercise of religion, which is posting the signs.
My exercise of religion is A. If she was punished for not A, Holt, match. If she says my exercise of religion is A and she's punished for B, mismatch, alternative means suddenly become relevant. It's a different equation. The same facts apply everywhere, so it becomes very confusing. That language in Holt can be very confusing. So what she had to say here was, you know, I put the three signs up. I wanted them in my workplace. There's a link to my religion for that. I had to put them on a shared workspace. I altered the words to be what we now realize and the judge realized were sticking it to her commands. And she didn't tell her superior about it. She just went around and she put them back up every time they were taken down. She knew she had to take them down. So she was, her exercise of religion that she claims is A, she was punished for something different. There's a mismatch there. So that's how the
but
government...
But in terms of sticking it to her NCO, isn't that an issue for the court below in terms of whether the appellant's beliefs were sincere? This isn't a situation, is it, where... a lance corporal gets to post signs that stick it to the NCO. The framework under RFRA permits the military command to address those situations. If there's a pretense, as was conceded by appellant's counsel, we're in a different sphere.
I was your question whether there should be more sincerity findings? Is that the question? Or I'm not
you
sure
seem to be trying to conflate or conflating this issue of whether RFRA applies.
Right.
With the issue of whether, in terms of sincerity, as compared to applying the framework that RFRA permits in terms of the trial court or the court below
right.
to make a finding about sincerity.
Let me give a shot at that. We're not saying that RFRA doesn't apply, Your Honor. We have a waiver argument. We think it's good. We're not doing that. I'm not making that argument now. I'm just saying that under substantial burden, let's say that she really did do it enough because she was a pro se litigant. What's on the record here is insufficient to demonstrate substantial burden for two reasons, for accommodation, which is a substantial burden issue, not a waiver issue, and the second issue is the mismatch issue. And I think the cases on page 52, even though the cases don't use this language about mismatch, that is what those cases are all doing. They're saying that if you say my exercise of religion is A, and what you're punished for is B, or what you're prohibited from doing is B, mismatch, no substantial burden, done. One of the confusing things, which I won't say the word again, but one of the confusing things about the statute is that those same facts apply to all the prongs. What appellant would like to do would be to segue nicely right to the compelling interest prong and start talking about why there's no compelling interest. I see my time is done, Your Honor.
Would you like to briefly conclude?
Yes, Your Honor. This is a case that is a garden variety orders a violation case, Your Honor. Appellant fails to demonstrate a substantial burden and fails to demonstrate a sincere practice of religion in this case. This is a plain and simple insubordination case, and her conviction should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few points in rebuttal. First of all, I would say this is anything but a garden variety case, and the very fact that the government had its entire argument and did not defend the Court of Appeals standard for religious exercise, I think is telling, and it's part of the reason why the record is perhaps suboptimal in some respects, but I don't think that should all be visited on my client, especially when, if you look at the brief they filed in the court below, it asked the court to jump right to compelling interest, right to least restrictive alternatives, and I think that's where some of the strength of our case lies. In any event, three specific points in rebuttal. First of all, I think it would be a huge mistake to impose a magic words test on pro se litigants when it comes to preserving RFRA claims. And I think that in thinking about the lower court record, you should keep in mind that when it got to the lawful order part of the analysis, the military trial judge had no problem identifying these as biblical verses. And that was what he suggested could threaten good order. It wasn't that they were biblical verses that everybody would read as telling the NCO what to do with themselves. It was that they were biblical verses, and that was problematic in and of itself. And I think that is very antithetical to what Congress is trying to accomplish in RFRA. The second point is this idea of the accommodation somehow becomes something that undermines the substantial burden test, and my friend invokes the Friday decision of the Tenth Circuit. I think the Friday decision, a couple of points should be made about that. First of all, if you read that decision, the point that he's trying to read it for is that as long as there's an accommodation potentially available, there's no substantial burden. That's not actually the holding of the case. The Tenth Circuit kind of tiptoed to the point of making that observation, but then said that's not really how we need to decide this case because they moved on. The second thing is, I think that's a very different situation. If there were a specific accommodation for religious postings at your desk and somebody didn't take advantage of it, I mean, I think that's the analogy to Friday, because Friday there's a specific government program for eagle feathers. And I think not taking account of a particular program that's targeted at your exact practice is different. And that's why I think the Ninth Circuit, when they considered this kind of accommodation, exhaustion issue in the Native American church case, decided it differently and said the fact that you could potentially get an exemption under the Controlled Substances Act is not.
There's many different religions, right? And look, religion good, terrorism bad. We all think religion, you know, religion is good. But there's many different religions and many possible different practices and a worldwide military system, right? And so wouldn't it be the case that the reason that they created this accommodation program is so that they can protect people's religious practices if they know about
them? Well, Your Honor,
if they know about them.
Absolutely. But, you know, they are to be commended for putting together the accommodation process. But I don't think, especially when you're talking about a congressional statute that gives you a defense, I think when it's invoked as a defense in particular, I think it's wrong to say, you know, well, the NCO at the time might not have known it was religion. This, when it's invoked as a defense in a special court-martial, that's the point at which the government is about to impose a very significant substantial burden on religious exercise, and then that's the point at which it should be explored. And I realize my time's up, so I will rest on that point. But we do think that this is a case where it's very important to reaffirm that RFRA does apply in the military context and that the Court of Appeals' definition of religious exercise was way too miserly. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. The Court thanks counsel for both parties. The case is now submitted. The Court will be in recess until further order of the Court.
All right.